Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and organize around the eco-socialist program that Angela Walker and I ran on in 2020. And, you know, the headlines, well, let me first talk about petitioning. I've been up since 5 this morning to get a spot at the regional market. It's a farmer's market, and got 180 signatures, which is the best I've done there. And generally, a lot of disgust with people with politics, both major parties. And for some of them, it bleeds over into somebody like me who's, you know, I say, we're trying to, you know, present an alternative to that. But people go, eh. And of course, there were, seemed a little bit more today to Dems were, you know, freaking out about Trump and, you know, they wanted to suppress the Green Party. And I would tell them, that's voter suppression. That's what Trump does, which would really piss them off, but didn't persuade any of them. But, you know, maybe I got them thinking. And then, of course, there were the Trumpies who just said, I'm for Trump. And, you know, there's nothing to talk about. So anyway, if any of you are within striking distance of New York, we got to one more week to get our signatures. We turn them in on May 28th. We need 45,000 good signatures. We've only had 42 days to collect them by May 28th. So all the help we can get. And if you come from out of state, you can get a petition with a certain kind of witness statement and you can witness signatures. So, and if you're in New York State, you know, this is the time to do what you can. So anyway, that's what we're doing in New York, and there are other states to come. So I hope everybody who can gets out there and petitions. But, you know, what I was saying is international issues are dominating the headlines. That doesn't mean climate change and affordable housing and access to affordable health care and all these other issues that, you know, we want to be talking about aren't important. It's just they're not being talked about. You know, what's dominating, of course, is the war in Gaza. And Biden made a gesture. He paused delivery of heavy munitions to Israel last week. And then he turned around this week and announced a new $1 billion military arms sales to Israel. And Israel has begun ground operations in Rafah, from which refugees are running to areas to get away from the bombing and the shooting. But they're going to areas where there's no food, no sanitation infrastructure to support them. So it's, you know, it's a real crisis just for the civilian people in Gaza. And, you know, Biden's been saying to Israel, don't go into Rafah until you got a place for these refugees. But Israel's going in. And the or else that Biden has warned Israel about turned out to be another $1 billion arms sales to Israel this week. So Biden is still joined at the hip with Netanyahu in this genocidal war in Gaza. And then Biden's hypocrisy was highlighted this week because there's a lot of talk about the two-state solution. The Arab League had its summit in Bahrain on Thursday, and they voted then for a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza war and for the UN Security Council to authorize sending in an international peacekeeping force to Gaza and the West Bank, where there's a lot of settler and Israeli army violence against Palestinians living there. And they want that peacekeeping force in there until there's the implementation of a two-state solution. And they also called on the UN Security Council to set up a timetable to get to a Palestinian state next to the Israeli state along the 1967 borders. And Antonio Guterres, who's the UN Secretary General, was at that summit. And he also said the two-state solution is, quote, the only permanent way to end the cycle of violence and instability. And that same day, Xi Jinping, who's meeting with Putin, again called for the two-state solution to this problem. And so then you have to ask, well, what was the U.S. response to all this talk about the two-state solution? And the U.S. the next day, Friday, yesterday, rejected the Arab League proposal, saying it would compromise Israel's war to destroy Hamas. In other words, the U.S. is still a full partner in Israel's genocidal war against the Palestinians. So the U.S. talks about a two-state solution, but it's hypocritical, empty rhetoric. And it's going to be that way until it stops arming Israel and votes when resolutions come before the Security Council to support the steps necessary to implement the two-state solution, which the Security Council has been calling for since Resolution 242 in November 1967, which that resolution, by the way, incorporated the 1948 Security Council Resolution 194 that affirmed Palestinians' right of return or to compensation for lost properties. That is where the international community stands. And only Israel publicly and the U.S. practically, without being so explicit about it, opposes this two-state solution, despite all the rhetoric about that's got to be the answer. Our actions, U.S. actions, undermine that. And, you know, Genocide Joe, as so many are calling him, with these policies, maybe just handing the presidency to Trump, who's even worse on the Palestinian question because of Biden's blind support for the slaughter of Palestinians. And Americans are seeing that. A Gallup poll at the end of March found that 55% of Americans disapprove of Israel's military campaign in Gaza. And a Reuters poll out Thursday, or maybe it was yesterday, found that 44% of Democratic voters disapprove of Biden's policy on Gaza. That's his own base. And of all voters, only 33% approved of Biden's handling of the war. These votes that he's going to lose on the Gaza policy may be the difference in the battleground states that puts Trump in there instead of Biden. I mean, why the hell is Biden destroying his own election in an unjust cause? It's just hard to believe to watch this happening. Another thing that came from Xi Jinping while Putin was there, I don't know what Putin's response was, but Xi Jinping called for a no first use treaty regarding nuclear weapons. China has that policy. India has that policy. The U.S. and USSR do, or USSR, Russia do not. USSR did not either. But the U.S. immediately responded by saying, we're not going to, talk about a no first use treaty. Our policy is maybe we'll go first. And instead, impose more tariffs on Chinese imports, particularly in the green tech sector for electric vehicles and storage batteries. And Biden says he's protecting the emerging U.S. electric vehicle and battery industries. But this trade war is going to slow down the building of clean energy systems right here in the United States. And, instead of a trade war, why doesn't the U.S. seek a partnership with China, giving them access to our market for their imports and cut a deal and saying, well, in return for that, put some of your production here in the United States where the technology will be transferred so that, in general, technology is really the common inheritance of humanity. And the idea that companies, whether they're here or in China, can patent them and monopolize them for a certain period in order to extract more profits is not in the common interests of humanity. So that's a whole nother question. China is definitely an authoritarian capitalist state, but trade war instead of economic cooperation is not going to change the authoritarian nature of the Chinese state. And I would argue that U.S. nationalism and protectionism only gives the Beijing regime the fodder for whipping up their nationalism domestically and gives them excuses for repression because they're threatened by U.S. nationalism and belligerency. So, we can criticize their human rights record, but we can still cooperate with them on practical things like green technology and no first use of nuclear weapons. This kind of foreign policy, and this is from Biden. what is Trump going to do? Nobody knows. Trump probably doesn't know. But it's not going to be rational. And another development, over the last week is, the Russians have now started a new offensive in Kharkiv in the northeast of Ukraine. And they've got a few miles into Ukraine. But what they're doing is what they do when they, always go on an offensive. They destroy, these are villages, and there's one small city They just flatten them to the ground. That's what they call liberation from, you know, supposedly Ukrainian language being imposed on Russian speakers. You know, this is a Russian speaking area. They speak Russian. They go about their business. Ukraine isn't stopping them from speaking Russian. And now these people are running from the Russian invasion. They tolerated the first Russian occupation of this area, you know, right after the full-scale invasion started. And they know what it's like. This time they're running because they don't want to be under Russian occupation anymore. And Russia is targeting these people as they run for their lives. And we also have video footage, and this is we've seen elsewhere, but now we see it from Kharkiv, of where Ukrainian soldiers surrender to Russian soldiers. They're getting summarily executed. These are war crimes, you know, the summary executions, the bombing of civilians fleeing the front line. And we have, you know, a lot of firsthand reporting of that bombing going on. So we have evidence, you know, again, of why we should support Ukrainians defending themselves from the Russian invasion, occupation, and settler colonialism in the occupied territories. Because what's going on is if you don't take out a Russian passport, you can't get nothing. And you don't start speaking Russian, they're turning it into the schools. They're drafting young people who are Ukrainians into the Russian army to fight Ukraine. You know, if you don't cooperate, you get questioned, maybe tortured. There's been sexual abuse. Children are being kidnapped to be taken to Russia to be re-educated as Russians. I mean, these are all war crimes. And that's why, you know, people don't want to be under Russian occupation. And then as those areas are depopulated, they're encouraging Russians to move in, like in the Mariupol, which was flattened. And now there's a little real estate boom going on in there, you know, bringing in Russian workers to build these apartments and commercial establishments. This is classic settler colonialism. That's what the Russian Empire was. Unlike the Western empires, which had overseas colonies, Russia just, you know, marched from, you know, the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea all the way to the Pacific Ocean. And they annexed and took over other nations, other ethnic groups, and, you know, tried to Russify them. Although that is hard to do because people, you know, they take their traditions underground. And, you know, that's what Ukraine did for centuries. So it's just all the more reason why, you know, we should support the Ukraine national liberation struggle. The other thing you're going to hear is that Ukraine is losing. It can't win. It should surrender and, you know, try to get some kind of peace terms with Russia. The fact is Russia is gaining small amounts very slowly on the front lines because they've had more ammunition. That's starting to change now that the U.S. finally passed its military aid and Europe's getting its act together better. And they're the Ukrainians are inflicting significant losses on Russian troops and vehicles as they, you know, launch these assaults. And with all the drones, they're easy to see and they get wiped out. So they are losing many more than the Ukrainians are. And then what the Ukrainians are doing is hitting the Russians behind the front lines. The Black Sea fleet has basically been driven out to the eastern edges of the Black Sea. Their air bases and their fighter jets are being targeted and hit. Their oil refining infrastructure is at the point where, you know, right now they have a 6-month moratorium on exporting oil and diesel. And it's beginning to hurt. So Ukraine is getting its licks in too. The problem here is like Netanyahu and Israel, Putin's plan to stay in power is endless war. But it's probably not sustainable for either of those killers, let's call them that, Netanyahu and Putin, as long as the people they are trying to oppress and as long as those people resist and the international community supports their resistance. So, you know, don't believe that Ukraine's about to collapse. They're not about to push the Russians out with a military offensive, but it's not a total disaster like, you know, some of the media narratives are. And then the other thing going on is in Georgia, 10 to 15% of that country has been out in the streets the last couple of weeks against a foreign agents law that's modeled after the Russian foreign agents law, which Russia used to repress opposition, political movements, civil society groups, lawyers, working for human rights, independent media and journalists. And now, the Georgia Dream, the ruling party in Georgia, which is ruled by a billionaire that made his money in Russia, wants to pass this law. And the opposition fears that it's going to be used against them like it was used against any critics of Putin in Russia. So this 10 to 15% on the street is on the scale that we saw in Ukraine during the Revolution of Dignity in 2013 and 2014. And I've been in touch and talking with Greens and socialists and trade unionists in Georgia. And they tell me that the majority of people in Georgia, and the polls say about 80%, want a democratic future as part of the EU. They don't want to be another authoritarian government or country modeled after Russia. And what this foreign agents law that they're opposing would do is set up a registry of NGOs and trade unionists and journalists and media. They get 20% or more of their funding from foreign sources, which in a poor country like Georgia is, how you get a lot of projects funded. And there's also money coming in, under the table from Russia to, back this dictator. I can't say his Georgian name off the top of my head, but you can look it up. The other thing is Russia occupies 20% of Georgia militarily, as it currently occupies about 20% of Ukraine. And that happened in 2008 when Russia helped two provinces declare their independence from the state of Russia. So this has been an ongoing issue there, except the difference between Ukraine and Georgia is Georgia's military is tiny, nothing like what Ukraine has been able to build up. And then many of its fighters have, left the Georgian military force to go fight in Ukraine against Russia. So the resistance to this foreign agents law, where it stands now is it passed their parliament. Their president, who's not with the Georgia Dream Party, vetoed it or is about to veto it. And then it goes back to the parliament and it'll probably be overridden and go into effect. So the resistance to the foreign agents law is going to try to find their expression in elections in October. But they're also worried that this law will be used against opposition candidates in order to rig the election. And all this could lead to a mass uprising that overthrows the government. If that happens, it could lead to further Russian military intervention, which the people, in the absence of a strong armed force, would have to resist with mass nonviolent direct action, like mass strikes. So anyway, this is a movement to keep your eyes on. The situation's very volatile. And I'm going to try to have a Georgian activist on this podcast sometime soon. So I just mentioned one other international crisis, which isn't getting the attention it deserves. And that's the civil war in Sudan, which is not so much a civil war between, movements that have a popular base, but two factions of the military. And foreign forces are lining up with one side or the other, including Russia and a bunch of the Arab states. And I won't break down who's on whose side, but both sides are wrong. There was a revolution in 2019 that got rid of the previous authoritarian ruler. And there was a transitional government that was supposed to be civilians and military jointly until there was a transition a couple years ago to civilian rule. But that's when the military made a coup. Now the military is split and they're fighting each other. And what's going on in Sudan, the starvation is much more massive than even in Gaza. And there's a fund that the UN is supposed to fund, or countries are supposed to put in that the UN set up, and it's not being funded. So people are starving when, if the US spends almost $1 trillion a year, I think this fund is $8 billion, and it's only got like $1 or $2 billion. I forget the numbers exactly. US could fund the whole thing. And it's like pocket change. They wouldn't notice the difference. But we're not doing that, nor is the international community is just pretty much shrugged her shoulders and worried about other things. And it's a real tragedy because, you know, many, many people are dying from starvation, not to mention the genocidal attack on the Africans by the Arabs. And, you know, if you look at these people, they look the same. They're black people. It just depends on their tradition. The Arabs are Muslim. The Africans are Christian. And it's ethnic cleansing in order to, you know, grab resources. It's just a terrible situation. So I just call that to our attention. And, you know, I think the thing we can demand of the U.S. is, you know, fund the food relief, at least, for these people who have, you know, fled to what they hope are safe zones or over the border to Chad, but they're starving. They need food. So anyway, on all that bad news, let's see what your comments and questions are. Okay, Georgian president vetoed the law today, but it will likely be overruled by the parliament. Yeah, I think they need 79 votes and the 84 voted for this law. So it'll probably be overridden. And the veto will be overridden and the law will go into effect. But the movement's not going to stop resisting. Boy, that's clear. There are masses of people out on the streets and they're clear what they want. They want democracy. That's really the bottom line. Violated Content Boutique. America's obsession with killing black and brown folk at home and around the world is just heartbreaking. Yeah, it's not what most people want us to be, but that's what we are, at least our government is. And it's why we need the Green Party. I mean, some of these conversations when I'm petitioning, you know, people tell me how bad Trump is. And I say, well, what about this about Biden and that about Biden? And they say, yeah, I can't justify that, but Trump is worse. Okay, Trump is worse, but, you know, we're still in trouble with Biden. That's why we need a political alternative. Scout Trooper 164, what are your views on Orban? The man makes my blood boil with how much pandering he's doing to Russia and China. Yeah, he's an authoritarian. He figured out how, like we're seeing in our country, you know, to get control of the judiciary, bended his way, and to basically make the political electoral system difficult for alternative parties. And he's, you know, whipped up resentments against immigrants, against other countries, you know, and nationalism. And so instead of dealing with real problems, he's pointing to scapegoats. It's the kind of politics, right-wing politics, is what Trump does. It's what this guy in Georgia is doing. He's saying all these people on the street are, you know, being paid by the CIA and stuff like that, as if people can't have their own reasons for rising up against repression and exploitation. So, yeah, I have a negative view of Orban. Isn't the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee or conference, having a conference over there? They've got an affiliate over there now. I think I just read that, you know, they're having a get together over there, you know, with Orban. You remember Orban going to visit Trump and, you know, those two are throwing compliments at each other. It's so, yeah, my view of Orban is he's not a good guy. Orban is the leader of Hungary, in case anybody didn't know. Wells, a horror in Ukraine. The left should have encouraged Ukrainians, should not have encouraged Ukrainians to get in bed with the US and NATO. For two decades, the left should have encouraged Ukrainians to stay neutral. Well, Ukrainians wanted to stay neutral until Russia attacked. If you look at the polling, support for joining NATO was, you know, like 20 or 30% until 2013 or 2014 when Russia sent their little green men, military people without insignia into Crimea and, you know, forced a referendum at gunpoint for independence and then annexed to Russia. And then they sent, you know, special forces aligned with the goons, the you know, criminal gangs aligned with oligarchs in the Donbas region. And so after that, the support for Ukraine joining NATO went up because they were looking for people to help defend them from Russian aggression. And then after the, you know, February 2022 full-scale invasion by Russia, I mean, that one of the polls I saw is like 2 or 3% don't want to join NATO. It's like they want NATO, you know, to help defend themselves. So, you know, in the much talked about peace agreement that wasn't finalized at the end of March and early April in 2022, at that point, you know, Zelensky and the Ukrainian government were willing to accept neutrality in return for security guarantees from the West and from Russia, that they would have their independence and territorial integrity respected. And in return for that, Ukraine would not join NATO. It would not go nuclear, which was already in their constitution. It would not have foreign troops based in Ukraine, which is already in their constitution. And, you know, they couldn't come to a deal on that. You know, and the reasons for that from the Ukrainian side, which have become clearer as more information has come out, is that, you know, people say Boris Johnson went there and told them not to sign the deal. No, what Boris Johnson told them was the West would not guarantee Ukraine's security in some kind of peace deal, which would be like an Article 5 agreement of NATO. In fact, stronger than Article 5, that NATO would then be obligated to come to, or any of these countries guaranteeing security would be obligated to go into Ukraine to fight Russian invasion militarily. And the West didn't want to do that. It wanted to give Ukraine the arms to fight for itself, but not send its own troops. So without the security guarantees, you know, Ukraine was reluctant to sign it. And then, and I've put this on many posts at the National Committee of the Green Party, and it's in an article citing me from Michael Karagias, who's a socialist anti-imperialist in Australia. He has a long Facebook series on myths about Ukraine. You know, before Boris Johnson ever got to Kyiv, Lavrov said the agreement as it stood was unacceptable because what Russia wanted was to take the lands that they were occupying in Zaporizhia and Kherson, as well as in the Donbass. And, you know, Ukraine wasn't agreeing to that. And then a couple of days after Boris Johnson was in Kyiv, Putin was saying, you know, the peace process is dead. They actually continued to talk for about another month, but that's as far as they got. So anyway, I'm just saying, I don't think the left encouraged the Ukrainians to get in bed with the U.S. and NATO. We oppose U.S. imperialism and NATO. The left is split on this. Some of them, you know, want to rationalize Russia's invasion, you know, saying NATO provoked them. Like a man beating his wife saying, I was provoked by her, so I'm justified. That's not right. And other parts of the left said we should support Ukraine, but not encourage them to be part of this military alliance called NATO. But in terms of what the Ukrainian people, they wanted to be neutral. They just wanted to be left alone by both sides. They were skeptical of both sides. They wanted to deal with both sides. And Russia's invasions changed their mentality. Now they want to be in NATO for security reasons. And it's not hard to understand why they think that. You know, let me add also, and I've advocated this all along, the U.S., and Russia says it wants to do this, but the U.S. should be much more aggressive in its diplomacy. Let's arrange a European-wide security architecture that satisfies everybody's real security needs. What Gorbachev called a common European home. And instead, the Clinton administration, you know, was very aggressive about pushing NATO out into former Soviet or Soviet-dominated states like Poland. And of course, those countries, the Baltic states in particular, wanted to be part of NATO because they feared Russian intervention again. But instead of negotiating, you know, a system where, you know, Russia was part of the collective security arrangement, we just, you know, allowed NATO to be pushed forward and treated Russia as an antagonist when early on it might have been able to cooperate. And there's a lot of evidence that Putin wanted to cooperate. He did cooperate with us. He enabled us to go into Afghanistan, letting us use Russian territory for the logistics supply to our invasion of Afghanistan. He was with us on the war on terrorism and really Islamophobia that was coming from our foreign policy. There was opportunities there that we lost. So I will say that, and I think we should resume that. When Putin put forward Russia's demands, really, for security or security treaties, the U.S. said, we're willing to talk about that. And they did respond. Putin put it forward, I think, December 21st, 2021, and the U.S. responded about January 25th, collectively with the EU. And it was a serious response. It didn't agree to everything that Putin put forward, but it responded and wanted to talk. There's a long political oral history of the people involved in the diplomacy between Russia and the U.S. throughout 21 and 22, which I think supports that the U.S. was willing to do that. But you look at what Putin put forward. He wanted NATO to go back to the 1991 borders before Germany reunified. And he wanted an answer in a few weeks. That's not a serious proposal because NATO was 30 countries then. Now it's 32. They have to agree to things unanimously. That just wasn't going to happen. So, you know, I think it was cover for Putin, who had already decided, and we have evidence for that as well, you know, decided about a year earlier that he was going into Ukraine. So anyway, I don't think you can blame the left for encouraging the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians responded to Russian aggression to want to get into NATO, most of them. But we should still pursue a collective security arrangement for the trans-European area that includes Russia. And, you know, that would be a way, if we get to negotiations, that would be a way for Putin to leave Ukraine, saying he accomplished his security objectives and not lose face. So anyway, long answer, but that's the way I look at it. Scout Trooper 164. Howie, isn't it unfair for the U.S. to prohibit Ukraine from using their weapons outside the border, despite Russia doing whatever it needed? No wonder Ukraine is trying to force the ban to lift. Okay, yeah. The U.S. has a stipulation on all the weapons it gives Ukraine. They cannot be fired over the border into Russia, which is the staging area for Russian invasion of Ukraine. And Ukraine has hit those areas, but with their own drones that they manufactured themselves. And the U.S. has said, we don't like that either. So the concern of the Biden administration is that if our and other Western weapons are used to hit Russians on Russian territory, it will escalate the war. Escalate it to what? Russia's pretty much full out in this Ukraine war. They're always threatening to use nukes, but they just don't have any use in this kind of thing because the troops are spread out along an 800-mile-long front. So, one nuke couldn't take them out. It would contaminate the area you're trying to, quote unquote, liberate. Just makes no sense. I think it's bluster on the part of the Russians. And they know that if they use them, there'd be massive response, even if it wasn't nuclear, from the West. And total condemnation. China's not having it. Every time Russia does, this fear-mongering with nukes, China condemns them. So I don't think that's a real possibility. So then the question is, you know, should we let the Ukrainians use U.S. weapons in targets over the border into Russia? And that's a tough question for me. I mean, on the one hand, there are military targets, like they're staging for the invasion of Kharkiv the last couple weeks is just over the border in the Belgorod Oblast of Russia. And, if you could hit their supplies, then you could impede the invasion. On the other hand, if it's U.S. weapons going into Russia, Russia can make a diplomatic hay of that, if not military. I just don't see what they can do militarily more than they're doing. They're at full capacity. And, A lot of military analysts say that, you know, if Russia doesn't make big gains this year, they're going to be in, they're going to be squeezed next year because they put so much of their, what is it, like 40% of their federal budget into the military, increased their military spending something like, you know, 140% this year. You know, and that's taken butter from domestic consumption to put it into guns for this military invasion. That can't be that long sustained. Plus, as big as Russia is, they're having trouble mobilizing people beyond what they've got this year. They do have a massive force. It's like, I think 450,000, something like that, in Ukraine right now in the occupied territories. So I don't know if fair is the way to describe it. The question is it smart to prohibit Ukraine? It's not fair that Ukraine can't strike back, but would it be smart for them to do so? And I think with their own weapons, you know, there's no political or diplomatic problem. With U.S. weapons, it's fraught. And I'll just leave it at that because I don't have a strong answer one way or the other. Scout Troop 164, isn't the fear of hitting Russian territory not just because of the nukes, but also because there's an economic connection between Russia and the U.S.? I don't think it's the Russian-U.S. connection. It may be the China-U.S. connection. China and the U.S. have massive trade and investment interactions. You know, China owns a lot of federal government bonds, you know, trillions worth. You know, the trade between the U.S. and China is massive. With Russia, not so much, and less so since this full-scale invasion. There are particular interests that would prefer to go back to business as usual and do business in Russia, you know, like ExxonMobil and Chevron, which had oil interests in Russia, oil and gas interests. And, you know, they may prefer to just, you know, get the war ended one way or another so we can go back in there and make money. There are, and, you know, they're not insignificant economic interest players in U.S. politics. But I think the big fear is nukes, not economic disconnection, because there's just not that much left to disconnect with Russia. Russia's, you know, economy in Russia is about the size of New York State. It's just not a big player in U.S. or world economics. Frankie Lee, why don't the rest of the world speak out more forcefully against the Gaza genocide? Are we so powerful that other countries cower before us? At this point, I think most of the world is speaking out, even the EU countries. They are getting fed up with this genocide in Gaza. I think the question is, why doesn't the U.S. speak up more forcefully? The U.S. people, and you know, get our government to change its policy. You know, besides, you know, handing the presidency to Trump, Biden is handing U.S. credibility around the world into the toilet. I mean, that was one of the things he said after the chaos of Trump and all his crazy stuff. He would restore respect for the U.S. by having, you know, a decent foreign policy, good relations with countries. And that's all being thrown away by sticking with Israel's aggression in Gaza. You know, it's really us that need to speak up. The rest of the world's speaking up. I mean, they've taken Israel to the International Court of Justice and taken them back, you know, last week. South Africa said, you know, order them not to go into Rafah. And, you know, most of the world, that's where it is. It's the U.S. is isolated with Israel, which is not a smart foreign policy. I mean, it's like dumb. And it's just astounding to watch this unfold. You know, I mean, Biden is, you know, they say domestic politics, you know, the American people aren't really paying that close attention. I mean, we get that from the polls. They're pretty much evenly split on, you know, whether they support the Palestinians or Israel, which is, you know, why is the question even raised that way? Why can't we support both of them living side by side peacefully. I mean, that should be what we should be for. It's just hard to watch this happen because it's tragic, you know, and Biden is, he's going to go down in history as the guy that handed the presidency to Trump and handed, you know, U.S. foreign policy, diplomatic chops to the toilet. It's to Trump who flush the toilet. It's just unbelievable to watch. Scout Trooper 164, could it be possible for China to take Taiwan without firing a shot? Apparently, experts believe that could happen. Well, take China. I don't think so. The Taiwanese will resist. The majority of people in Taiwan consider themselves Taiwanese, not Chinese. There was an indigenous pre-Hun Chinese population there, and a lot of the people that came over are Han Chinese. Who are Han Chinese, have taken on a Taiwanese, or their descendants have taken on a Taiwanese identity. They had a transition from authoritarian to democratic rule that they're very proud of. They don't want to surrender that. I don't know what experts think the Taiwanese would roll over for the Chinese. And I think China, you know, you get a lot of fear talk from, you know, military hawks, but I think, you know, long-term reunification, what's the word I saw? I was reading someone the other day. It's not reunification, but I forget what it was. The Taiwanese have there are economic reasons why China would not want to ruin Taiwan, particularly right now in the computer chip industry. One theory is that the more they have economic relations, the less likely it is China would want to use military to take over Taiwan. Diplomatically, the world doesn't recognize Taiwan as an independent state, but as a province of China. I don't think China will take over Taiwan without firing a shot. The question is, could they overwhelm them economically? I don't think so. Taiwan is no joke economically. They can pull their own weight. I think, you know, the intertwining of Chinese and Taiwanese businesses, cross investment, trade, supply links, supply chains, all that makes it against the interest of the Chinese to forcibly take over Taiwan. So I think, you know, we should just try to preserve the status quo, not, you know, provoke China, but also, you know, defend Taiwan's right to self-rule, whether it's a state in the United Nations or not. And over time, I think that will work itself out. But anyway, I don't think China's about to go into Taiwan. It just would be very costly for them, and they wouldn't be popular in Taiwan. It'd be a mess. Vicky Corden, here in Florida, DeSantis passed bills against climate change and against employers providing shade and water for workers. The Republican cruelty has no end. Yeah, I mean, how can they get away with that? I mean, where are the Floridians? I don't know Florida politics. I know it's moved to the right. It used to be a toss-up state. Now it's seems to be more solidly Republican, although the abortion issue, I believe, is on the ballot in Florida. That may put Florida back in play in 2024, although I haven't seen it listed as a battleground state by any analyst. So, yeah, it's cruel. It's just cruel. And it's dangerous for the workers, you know. Heat exhaustion, heat stroke. That happens on, you know, even with workers that can't get shade and get water on hot days. It's unbelievable. Scout Trooper 164, do you think Russia is doing covert ops in Western countries? There have been attacks and fires on factories producing equipment and ammo for Ukraine. Yeah, no doubt. That's what secret intelligence agencies do. We do it. Russia does it. Iran does it. China does it. But Russia's very good at it. I think the most effective thing they're doing are their influence operations, their propaganda. It's unbelievable to hear, you know, standard Kremlin lines on Ukraine repeated in Congress, repeated in the National Committee of the Green Party. You know, left and right, people are buying this nonsense without really doing their own investigation. Now, the sabotage you're talking about, I don't know of any particular sabotage. I think there's some suspicion in maybe the UK. But that is, I would say that's not the most effective thing they're doing. And I don't think they'd make it a major issue, because if they get caught, you know, that's a casus belli. I mean, that's a reason to go to war, or at least make life even more miserable for Russia and the world economy. So, but I think their influence operations, very effective. You know, they have the Russian state media, but they also have a lot of, you know, websites and bloggers that amplify those narratives in cyberspace. And, it reaches from far left to far right. It's been quite impressive, you know, as I've studied the Ukraine war, to see, you know, how effective Russia's been in getting its, you know, I mean, some of these things are just hard to believe. Anybody would believe them, but they do, you know, like, you know, the Maidan Revolution was a coup, as if there was a military coup. In fact, you know, the president ran off, the parliament voted in a new president and called for new elections in a few months. That's not what you call a coup. That's a transformation. It's a political revolution. Of course, the left in Ukraine wants a social revolution. In other words, less neoliberalism and more socialism. That's what they're fighting for, along with the trade unions there. And, you know, going back to the earlier question, I mean, the thing the left tells us is we're fighting Russian tanks and Western banks. You know, we in the West should be calling for the cancellation of Ukraine's debt. Most of it originally incurred by Yanukovych, the guy that ran off to Russia when the Maidan uprising happened. And he got it from Western banks and issued, you know, government bonds, and also took $3 billion from Russia. That was the alternative to the EU trade agreement that kicked off the protests in Maidan Square in November 2013. And Russia's in court now in the Supreme Court of the UK, demanding that Ukraine immediately pay $3 billion back to Russia for that loan that Yanukovych took out. And Ukraine is saying that was made under duress of Russian intervention, and we don't owe it. So that's playing out in court right now, although courts move pretty slow. So I don't know, you know, when the last hearing was or when the next one was, but it's in the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom. Yes, the abortion issue is on the ballot in Florida. Well, I hope the people of Florida just crush the Republicans on that issue. You know, women's right to reproductive health services is her right. And, you know, this anti-abortion stuff is really dangerous to people's lives. And it's just mean-spirited. It's misogynistic as can be. So good luck in Florida. I hope you guys win that referendum by a landslide. I heard, I believe, it was the FBI is warning people of possible attacks during pride parades anywhere in the world. Any thoughts? Wow. Coming from what sources? I mean, one of the big kicks of these authoritarians in Georgia, in Russia, in many African countries, in Iran, is, you know, scapegoating LGBTQ people. And so violence against, you know, people talk about the far right in Ukraine. It's much smaller than any other European country. I mean, they got less than 2% of the vote in the last election. And we got Trump, who might win this election. You know, the alternative for Germany and that guy in the Netherlands, who's now their prime minister. And in Italy, I mean, the right and Marine Le Pen in France, they're much stronger than the far right is in Ukraine. But the far right, you know, this small group, small current in Ukrainian politics, they attack Pride Parade or historically have. Although the tolerance for LGBTQ people in Ukraine is really going up. There's legislation pending. And the people aren't tolerating that crap from the far right now, particularly when they have to be united against the Russian invasion. So in any case, this far right attack on LGBTQ people, that's far right politics, scapegoating. You know, it's not the government not carrying through good policies or implementing good policies that have been adopted or failing to do so, or corruption and, you know, all the things that go on in government. It's not that, or it's not the system. It's these other people, LGBTQ, immigrants. Those seem to be the favorite targets for the far right in the Western world these days. But in other countries too, I mean, look at Uganda. You know, the legislation criminalizing LGBTQ is, you know, pretty disgusting, but it's also a way that Museveni is trying to keep power. He's not particularly popular. He's been in power forever, and he's turning people's heads. You know, look at those gay people over there, rather than at the real problems of the country. So if the FBI is warning that there'd be attacks on pride parades, you know, that probably goes on some good intelligence, and it's sad to hear. Howie, if it were up to you, how would you go about rebuilding the railroad tracks between Scranton and New York City? I would have a national rail corporation under a combination of workers, railroad workers, and public control, democratic, and it would go about rebuilding all our railroads. And with the view of replacing a lot of the over-the-road truck freight hauling with hauling by rail, and then you have electric trucks going the last miles to very, you know, from the railroad depot to Walmart or wherever the goods are being distributed, or to the factory where the raw materials are going. And the same thing with public transportation for, you know, regular people. You know, instead of driving your car from Scranton to New York City, you get on the train. And it should be more convenient and less costly than having your own private vehicle, insurance, maintenance, wear and tear on that trip, and just hop on a train and leave the driving to them. That's what we need to do. And that's, it would rationalize our transportation system. It would be a big contribution to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and protecting the climate, because the railroads should be electrified, not burning diesel fuel, which you don't need to do. I mean, all the diesel fuel does is turn a generator for electric engines and railroads as it is now. So you just need another source of electricity, which can be wind and solar and other renewables. So if it were up to me, we'd have a national rail corporation that would run the railroad system in this country. And the system should be structured so it's democratic from the bottom up. So it's responsive to the people that use the railroads and the people that work on the railroads. Richard Pink, we need an inter and intrastate bike path system. Yes, I totally agree. And inter and intra-city bike path system. So it's safe to, you know, One of the things I'm reluctant to get out on the roads is I've known too many people been killed riding their bike, doing everything correctly, and just getting hit by a car. They should be on different paths. There was a young green activist in Maryland who was training for, I think, the triathlon. She'd get up at 5 in the morning, do her run or a bike ride. I think she was run over riding her bike. And she was a very promising young woman. And, so I think motorized vehicle traffic and bicycles should be on different paths, segregated as much as possible for safety reasons. Steve, yeah, I saw this in the chat. I was going to answer it even if it didn't get pop up here. Do you have a sense of the prospects for success regarding the New York petition drive? I think it's touch and go, Steve. People are out there petitioning. The Stein campaign has hired petition management firms who have made promises to come in with good chunks of the signatures we need. So my best guess at this point is that we're going to have more than 45,000 to turn in. The question will be, do we have enough of a margin over 45,000 to sustain a challenge? And I think there's a good possibility, although not certain, that the Democrats won't bother in New York. They will focus on keeping the Greens off the ballot in the competitive battleground states. New York, Biden's going to win, unless, something unforeseen happens. Trump doesn't have a chance. So the Democrats are much more relaxed about the Greens getting on the ballot. And all we do if we get Jill Stein and her running mate on the ballot for this fall election is they're on the ballot one time, unless they get 2% of the vote, which in 2020 was 173,000 votes. The old standard was 50,000 votes. So they more than tripled it. And the best Jill ever did in New York was just over 100,000. So even if we get on a ballot, we're still going to have a challenge of getting enough votes that we can have a ballot line for 2 years. Used to be you get 50,000 votes for governor and you get a ballot line for 4 years. Now you got to meet the 2% standard, which is about 175 to 200,000 every 2 years for president, governor. And they made other things, more difficult. It's the most difficult petition we found in the world. In Putin's Russia, if you want to run for statewide office, which is representative in the Duma, their national parliament, from an oblast like their states, it's 15,000 signatures gathered in 45 days. The old New York standard was 15,000 in 42 days. So Russia was a little more liberal, but basically the same. Now our standard is 45,000 in 42 days, three times harder than in Russia. And very few people in Russia meet that standard or try to. And I've been joking with the state legislators, we just want to get back to the Putin standard. And in fact, today petitioning, I saw one of my state assembly person. And she said, I can't sign that. I get in trouble. I said, I understand. But she got her husband to. She actually suggested. Well, I think I just gave it away. But anyway, he did sign. And, I told her about that. And I said, I'm trying to get, legislators to get behind a fair ballot access law. And if we just go back to the status quo ante, we can deal with that. That's the Putin standard. And she chuckled. And they always chuckle. Although my representative is pretty good. I think I can work with her. So I was glad I ran into her. Anyway, those are some of the ins and outs of ballot access in New York. But at this point, I think we're, going to have a very good shot of getting over 45,000 signatures. And you're in New Jersey, Steve. So any help you can or any other New Jersey people can give, we could use. We can have out-of-state petitioners. There's a certain form for the witness statement you need to use, and we have those. So, this is it. It's basically 10 days from now, May 28th, but we have to start sending the petitions down to New York City at the end of this coming week. They have to get there by the weekend so that the petitions can be assembled. One of the things we got to do is identify 500 signatures in half the congressional districts that are good. That's five times more than the old standard, which was 100 signatures in half the congressional districts. That's a monster job. You got to go through each signature and find out what CD they are and then put it on a list and tell the Board of Elections, this is where our signatures in this congressional district are. It's a massive job. And all this is just so our candidates can run. I mean, one of the things when I'm petitioning out there is people can't believe, you know, they'll say, wait, the Green Party's on the ballot. I've seen you on the ballot. And I'm pretty well known in Syracuse, and I run many times. They say, I voted for you recently. And I tell them, not for the last 4 years. We haven't been on a ballot. So this is important, and I hope folks in New Jersey, as well as those of you listening in New York, or if you're in Connecticut or anywhere, Pennsylvania, we've had Pennsylvania people come up and help. This is the week to do it. So, yeah, we're within striking distance, so let's get it done. Steve Wilson, we're trying to get a full slate of candidates on the ballot in New Jersey. Our own petitions are due soon also. Well, you know, I know you're trying to get every congressional seat with a candidate, and that's great, and your petitioning is more reasonable, but you got to get your take care of your own house first. I understand that. But if anybody can come up and help us, we could use it in New York. Okay, well, thanks everybody for being here today. I'm working on getting some guests so you don't always have to listen to me the whole hour. And I just don't have anybody confirmed at this point, but that's coming up. And we'll be here next week and we'll just keep talking and figuring out what we need to do. And so I appreciate everybody being here. Have a good week. If you're in the New York area, get some signatures and get them in. And, you know, let's keep plugging away. It does make a difference. Have a good week.